Welcome to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Well, of course, that wouldn't even to say that to throw out the prospect of doing away with television is to invite ridicule. But actually, I think it's a very good idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a very serious book written about 10, 15 years ago. What was it? 7, 8, 9, 10 arguments for the abolition of television?
Well, we're the genie's out of the bottle. We're not going to be able to do away with television. Television has become a symbol of the kind of mass consumer society in which we live, in which instant gratification is the norm. It's the measure we use for any kind of communication, and political communication is no different.
Of course, the struggle for civil rights predates our history as a nation. It's still going on, and it's going to continue to go on so long as things like race and class and culture divide us. Unfortunately, that's just the truth. The press, of course, was delinquent in not discovering the problems that led to the civil rights movement and giving the proper amount of attention to those problems without having that forced upon the press by the civil rights struggle.
The Press, the People, and Public Policy, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with Claude Sitton and Dan Carter, both of Emory University. Before his appointment as a senior lecturer at Emory University, Claude Sitton was editor-in-chief of the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina. In 1983, he won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Dan Carter teaches in the Department of History at Emory University. He recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a political biography of Governor George Wallace of Alabama. I asked Claude Sitton and Dan Carter to reflect upon the press, the people, and public policy. Claude Sitton.
Well, when we talk about the press, we're talking about both print and broadcast. And I think that television, really, and not necessarily through any fault of television, has greatly reduced the quality of political discourse in this country. Mm-hmm. We've gone to the 20 or 30 second soundbite. We have people getting most of their political information from TV commercials rather than from TV news or from debates. And really, you don't have anything today that's a real debate on television because the candidates themselves put so many restrictions uh-huh. on those who would conduct debates that the result is almost nil.
Well, Dan Carter, it sounds like we've got a man sitting here who's being nostalgic. He's looking back to, was there a good old days when politics was politics and people understood what was going on?
I suppose it depends on how far is the good old days, how far back you're going. And it's not just nostalgia to say that certainly the level of political discourse, even in the 1940s and 1950s, was better than it is in the 1980s and 1990s. You look back to something like the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960, and it's astonishing the level of give and take that took place even as late as 1960. And I see the real changes taking place in the mid-60s and into the 1970s.
Well, what do you mean by give and take? Are we talking about the substance of what political candidates talk about and therefore the substance of what the electorate has available to it? Or are we talking about the style, the glitz and the bells and whistles, the way politics gets covered, Claude?
No, we're talking about discussion of issues, which mm-hmm. we don't really have today. No give and take on issues. We get these commercials, you know, which appeal to the emotions rather than to the mind. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, at the same time, we have a trend running in newspapers today where many newspapers are trying to compete with television as entertainment, mediums of entertainment, which they cannot do and which they're going to fail at, and that's tragic. But even more tragic is the fact that this is going to deny the American people comprehensive coverage, the depth coverage they must have to understand public affairs in this country. Reading is work.
Right.
Watching television is not.
It also has to do with what, for lack of a better word or phrase, I would describe as a sense of powerlessness on individuals' part. I mean, in part, people are not involved in politics because they think it's irrelevant. They believe, and I think almost all social science studies have shown this over the last 8 to 10 years, people have a sense, these statistics of non-political participation, the lowering levels of voter participation, simply are a way of measuring what we sense already, and that is that people believe that politics are irrelevant to their lives.
And yet they'll want to complain about taxes, or they'll want to go out and raise petitions or banners about issues like abortion. Those aren't political. People aren't engaged in those things, Claude.
But let me just add another point to what Dan said there.
If
you'll go back and look, you'll find that the decline in voter participation roughly parallels the increase and the importance of television in American society.
Uh-huh.
The two run, you know, arm in arm.
We're back to that villain. Well, what about the print journalists? Let's take them on just as we're taking on the television people.
Sure.
I remember an old story going around about how USA Today has been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize in the investigative paragraph. what about this? I mean, you guys, after a fashion, are reductionists, too, are you not?
Oh, you got a point. I agree, and I think, as I said before, it's a very unfortunate trend. We're not going to get the kind of discussion and thought about public affairs that we must have in this country,
mm-hmm.
where issues are growing increasingly complex, with the kind of coverage that the new journalism, quote, is producing.
Well, when you were the editor of the News and Observer over in Raleigh, I'll invite you to either present me with a fictional scene or something that really may have happened. Did you ever sit around with your reporters and say, the stuff that we're doing is not substantial enough? It's got to be deeper. I mean, we have this wonderful phrase, coverage in depth, whatever that means.
Well,
how did you go about this?
Well, every day, but there you that's a generality. You're dealing in specifics. You'll say, look, you've left a hole in this story that you could drive a truck through. Now, let's plug it up. What does this really mean? That's the importance of print journalism today, to provide the meaning, the why, as opposed to the what and the when and the where.
Well, where did it go, Claude Sitton? I mean, how did we get away from providing the sense of causality and intertextuality, all of that?
Well, I don't think it's disappeared from papers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, or for that matter, from the News and Observer.
Mm-hmm.
But it is becoming scarce in a number of other newspapers, and USA Today, to some extent, bears the credit or the blame,
mm-hmm.
Whichever you choose to, however you choose to characterize it. But I'm concerned by the trend. As I say, I don't think newspapers can compete with television as mediums of entertainment.
Do you think that this trend is reversible? I mean, what is the responsibility of the professional journalist, and how does that journalist talk to the professional historian, Dan?
Well, I'll go back to the question of whether it's reversible or not. I think we have to act on the assumption that this is one of a number of trends that may run their course and then find a kind of self-correction at the end of the time. I mean, I had a long and sometimes angry debate with a member of the Atlanta Constitution, my own hometown newspaper, about his belief that newspapers were too discursive and what we needed was shorter, punchier writing. In other words, what we need is USA Today, and that most people are not interested in a story which runs over very much from front section to front page to a later period. And that's a kind of superficial description of the dispute, but I think it reflected a very substantive disagreement about my notion, which is that newspapers have an obligation to furnish that kind of background and depth, mm-hmm. that newspapers don't.
Well, Claude Sitton, who's running the newspapers?
Okay.
The journalists or the accountants or the people who go out and do demographic surveys about, you know, the audience wants glitz and flash and brevity?
Well, today it's the marketers, the people who do the surveys to some extent. But what many newspapers are trying to do as a result of pressure from advertisers and others is to provide 70-80% of the market readers. That's impossible. a good 25% of Americans are illiterate or semi-literate at best. You're not going to get them to read newspapers. There's another 25% whose interests are so narrow, focused in one area, be it, for example, drama, the theater, science, what have you, and you know,
soap opera.
I'm using areas at the top of the scale, but their interests are so narrowly focused that they're going to subscribe to publications that appeal to them because of their special nature.
But that
leaves you about 50%, and that's the best you're going to be able to do. Now, if you start trying to be all things to all people, you're going to wind up losing that 50% because you're not going to give them the information that they need to function in today's world.
Well, ironically, what you're doing, Claude Sitton, is reinforcing the argument that television ought to be the medium of political discourse because, by its nature, it is the medium of widest distribution, and that, by contrast, the newspapers are going to become precious little political journals, regional kinds of things.
I'd be the last to deny that the potential is there, but it's not being exercised.
What about this, Dan?
Well, think about this. I mean, I not to play historian, but I keep, as we were talking here about television, I keep thinking about that great radical Herbert Hoover of the 1920s when broadcasting was first coming in.
Right.
And Hoover made a speech in the mid-1920s in which he said what a great tragedy it would be if the airwaves, which are owned by the United States public, they're not they don't really belong to broadcasters, but are on loan to them by the American people. If these airwaves, he said, were turned over to the elements of pure mass commercialization, what a tragedy it would be, that there is a real opportunity here for using broadcasting in ways that educate and illuminate the issues of today. And I'm glad Mr. Hooper's not around to see what's happened to it, because the assumption now is that of course it is that television, radio, for the most part, one of the great things about having public television, public radio, is you can shut off onto that for the 3 or 4 or 5% of the American people that want to hear that kind of thing, serious programming. And the rest of it can be simply one great big junk market for commercials.
Well, let's use that as a jumping-off point to consider a second issue here, Claude Sitton and Dan Carter, and that is to say a sense of history that people have, that they draw upon, a sense of historical context, so that the headlines make sense to them, not only in the immediate circumstance, but they allow an opportunity for reflection about, you know, forgive the pretense here, but the meaning of it all, where we came from and where we're headed. What about the responsibility of the journalist to fill in that kind of gap? Claude Sitton?
Well, the journalist certainly has a responsibility there, especially to look to solutions in other areas of problems in the area that the journalist is trying to serve, and to point them out, to help people cope. But to me, the basic problem there is, one, the public schools, the curriculum, the changes there that have eliminated or rather denigrated history and civics or political science and things of that kind.
Redefined them.
And then take it on up to the university level, where today you have very few universities with a core curriculum. Brooklyn College is one, University of Chicago another, St. John's of Maryland's another. But most other universities lack that strong core curriculum, that devotion in the first 2 years of undergraduate work to the traditional arts, sciences, and social sciences that are so important. That's where you get your background in history.
What about this, Dan Carter? You make your living professing history. Do you think Americans have a usable past? I mean, you know, you historians like to come up with books that have titles like that. What is a usable past? How do Americans get one?
Well, history is something that makes sense to people, I think, and when we say that Americans don't have any sense of the historical past, I think we do need probably to stop and think for a moment about the changes that have taken place in the last 60 or 70, 80 years, in which we're really aiming now, we've really aimed at something that I think is possible, is feasible, but we haven't achieved yet, and that's a truly educated, broadly educated public. When we talked about a sense of the past in the 19th century, the fact that that people read history much more widely than they do today, what we were really talking about was a 10% or 15% of well-educated people who formed elites in this country. And the real failure has been in the last, I think, 60 or 70 or 80 years to, as we broaden public education beyond that 10 or 15% that was always there, to bring bring this curriculum, bring history alive to people who are outside that, that very small percentage, and we haven't done it.
Well, should we complain that we have at least aimed widely? I mean, isn't that the nature of the democratic experiment, to embrace as many as possible? And if we fail to the degree that they're not all literate, that they're not all conversant with what we call the past, well, so what? Maybe that's the price of living in a democracy. How about this?
Well, that of course assumes that 30, 40, 50% of the population is simply incapable of absorbing what we think of as the basic rudiments of a good, solid liberal arts education.
Well,
I don't believe that.
Maybe not incapable, but indifferent to it. They're simply not engaged with it, so we leave it to this rather small percentage of people who do read and practice and think about history.
That's pretty disturbing if you believe in a democratic society in which, as Jefferson tried to suggest in the 18th century, the real hope for the survival of something that in the 18th century was so outlandish and absurd was was a general population which was educated, able to take responsibility for and to take a role in decision making, if not directly, at least indirectly.
Well, how about Claude? I think the
population is taking a role in decision making today, but I'm concerned as to whether it's a positive role, and it's doing so through polling.
There's a word we haven't used yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, pollsters today, and polls have become very, very popular in newspapers. You know, USA Today, has almost a poll a day, and some other newspapers follow suit.
Makes for great charts and graphs and stuff.
But I saw a poll the other day in which, and this was not in USA Today, in which people were being asked whether they could afford to be sick. Then I saw another poll in which people were being asked how many miles they expected to travel over the Christmas holidays.
Real hard news stuff, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what this contributes, but yeah. many of the polls are simplistic and shallow. But I do think that polling has done one thing. I think it's reduced the power of the executive branch of government, because back in the old days, a president, let me just take a second to explain what I mean. Back in the old days, a president would consult with his cabinet. He'd make a few calls around the country, and then he would make his decision. Not so today. Today, the president and his cabinet and his advisors, who actually are more important to him than the cabinet, consult the polls. Mm-hmm. And the polls reflect sometimes great divisions among the populace as to what is the right direction to go, and they thereby limit presidential action.
This dilemma, I don't think, has ever been absent from the American political system, at least since we've had a relatively true democratic society. I mean, you go back to the man who stands as a kind of standard for all politicians, Abraham Lincoln. A great moral figure, but an individual who was always aware of public opinion, always conscious, always reaching out, trying to talk to advisors and people who could tell him about what the public thought. But he wasn't paralyzed by it, because he did not, it wasn't just his own strengths as a political leader and his own integrity. He did not have the kind of restraints that modern American political leaders have, in which the fact is, given the nature of the mass communication system, given the nature of the mood of the American public, he has to be responsive. He has to listen and to be concerned about public opinion, because, in fact, it can be devastating in a society so closely tied together by mass communication when it turns on him. We can see this very clearly in the beginnings of the Iraqi crisis, when President Bush was constantly thrashing about, trying to come up with not only what was in fact a rationale for America's presence in the Middle East, but also what the public would support as America's the rationale for America's presence in the Middle East. And the two, it was at times an almost comic kind of process in which you gave a speech and waited to see how that played with the American people and got the polls back and tried it again the next week. I'm sure something like that has always gone on, but never instantaneously in the way that it does now.
Let's look a little more narrowly at a project that Claude Sitton is engaged in, and that is the relationship among and between our sense of history, journalism, politics, and the civil rights era. A lot of the criticism about the press was that the reporters were a bunch of liberals, that they were out to change the political and social agenda of the United States, that they were, of course, observing and covering and writing stories, but more than anything else, they were actors themselves in the struggle for civil rights in this country. How about that, Claude? Did you get accused of that sort of thing?
Oh, sure you're accused of it, but I would dispute that. There were a few instances in which television cameramen were accused rightly of encouraging somebody to throw a rock, that type of thing, but mm-hmm. that was not commonplace. But back in the civil rights era, I think you've got to consider that the issues were very stark. You would go into counties where not a single black person was registered to vote, and had he or she come down to the registrar's office and sought to place his name or her name on the rolls, that could have led to death. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty stark. And you don't have to have a biased press to arouse emotions when you report that type of thing. I think people forget, for example, that in Birmingham, well, all of Alabama, in the ABC stores, alcohol beverage control stores, they had separate lines for blacks and whites labeled as such, with steel pipes as stanchions between them. You had, you know, separate water fountains. Blacks, as they, you know, as most people are aware, sat at the back of the bus.
Mm-hmm. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Claude Sitton and Dan Carter, we've talked about usable past. We've talked about politics and television and journalism. E.B. White, the essayist for The New Yorker, had a wonderful piece way back in the 1930s. He was writing about television, and he said, either we're going to have this wonderful white shining light in the sky, or we're going to have this miserable technological burden that we're going to carry around with us. Are you too optimistic about this this interplay? What do you see? Claude, let me begin with you.
Well, I'm ambivalent. I suppose, pessimistic. But I think we've got to recognize one thing about television and the press. The press generally is driven by events. The press has no magic Aladdin's lamp whereby it can impart knowledge and wisdom by simply rubbing ink on paper.
Yeah.
Can't be done.
It's local and it's episodic, huh?
It's local, it's episodic. The daily press, of course, is driven by daily events, and we can't look to it for a great deal of wisdom, although I think we could provide more than we're providing. I think one of our problems is that we restrict our reporters and our editors too much when it comes to analysis and opinion. I frankly think that the British and the European press sometimes come closer to the truth, mm-hmm. even though they are more opinionated, far more opinionated than the American press.
Dan Carter, I'll give you the last word. How about it?
Well, I'd like to return to television in a minute, because although I share Claude's pessimism, because I don't think there's any easy way out of this, just because there's no ultimate or perfect solution, I don't think we ought to give up. I think television is too important in terms of its role, the role that it plays, and I think we ought to be beginning that process. It's very slow and very difficult of agitating for and pressing demanding that the commercial television interest in this country, and I realize it's complicated by the rise of television and cable vision, but the commercial television interest in this country take a greater public responsibility in demanding that candidates, that we demand that candidates set aside time in political campaigns for serious, in-depth, and head-to-head kinds of debates in which they, the voters, the viewers, have a chance to see for themselves and not to depend upon 15-second sound bites.
Well, and just a quick footnote, how are you going to get the audiences to sit still for that? Television has, by its nature, conditioned people not to want to look at it.
Well, that may be true. That's the assumption upon which we're acting. But in fact, that's not altogether true. I mean, you go back to the real presidential debates, as imperfect as they were, and they were, believe me, they were imperfect. They draw, if given the right circumstances, they can draw a substantial, not a majority audience. I don't anticipate that, but a substantial audience that is willing to listen, particularly, I think, to something that they think is not a fraud, and to a considerable degree, the debates as they have evolved over the last couple of elections are a fraud. But again, an open head-to-head kind of confrontation, and that's what it would end up being if the ground rules were opened up between candidates, I think would be one very small step in the process of using television to illuminate issues of public policy rather than to confuse them.
Claude Sitton and Dan Carter teach at Emory University. In 1983, while serving as editor-in-chief at the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina, Claude Sitton won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Dan Carter recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, where his project was a political biography of Governor George Wallace of Alabama. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on the Press, the People, and Public Policy is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 569. That's program number 569. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, listen for a conversation with historian Richard Slatta of North Carolina State University. Wayne Pond will talk to Richard Slatta about his book, Cowboys of the Americas, recently published by Yale University Press. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial funding for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Press, the People, and Public Policy, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for Claude Sitton and Dan Carter of Emory University. Claude Sitton is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Dan Carter has written widely about race and politics in the modern South. Why are Americans indifferent to politics? Is the press doing its job? The Press, the People, and Public Policy, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.